If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 539, Extend the Pretend, with guest James Howard Kunstler. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to play a portion of a conversation that I recorded with James Howard Kunstler at his house a couple of weeks ago. In this conversation, you will hear us talking about our thoughts about what's going on and what will be going on in Venezuela. That's not the whole conversation, but it's a portion of it. And events have moved rather quickly on that front since then. So just keep in mind that our comments here are a couple of weeks out of date. So a little bit of background for people who are new to this podcast or just tuning into this episode because somebody sent it to you or, you know, for whatever reason, you don't really know the history of this show. This show started back in October of 2006. And at the time, I was a libertarian. I was staunchly against the drug war. I was a bit of a singularitarian, but with a bit of a psychedelic mystical twist to it. I was still pretty excited about the possibility that Terence McKenna was right about what would be happening on December 21st, 2012. I was not interested in peak oil. In fact, my only exposure to peak oil at the time was from somebody who was a very obnoxious leftist on LiveJournal, somebody who, long before the term was in use, I think could fairly be described as a social justice warrior of the most obnoxious variety. And peak oil was one of his talking points, so I just categorized it with stuff that annoying leftists say and thought nothing further of it. Until I started talking to people like Dmitry Orlov, Albert Bates, and this week's guest, James Howard Kunstler. I want to read a piece of feedback that I received on a YouTube video. This is one that I posted near the beginning of the year. It is called Peak Oil Bullshit, Part 1. So far, there are four parts to this series. And before I read the comment, I should say that YouTube is a very different medium than podcasting, particularly the sort of podcasting that I do, which is very much a relic of an earlier age in terms of, you know, internet time. On this podcast, I am largely speaking to people who either agree with me or are agreeable to the way I go about investigating topics, even if they disagree with my conclusions. And it is a very congenial affair and enterprise, as you can tell by my tone. YouTube's a different beast. On YouTube, the feedback that I get is mostly insulting, it is mostly adversarial, and I have adopted my own approach, not deliberately, not consciously, and it's not something that I'm planting a flag in, but I do tend to get adversarial with the audience, even in the recording process. I will sometimes basically unload on the audience, or some segment of it that I imagine to be watching. So, in response to Peak Oil Bullshit, Part 1, Physics Nerd 1 wrote, "The Earth doesn't have a creamy nougat center of oil. We're burning over one-third of a trillion barrels of conventional every 10 years, over 1,000 barrels per second. Conventional won't be a bell curve. It will be a shark's fin, thanks to tertiary drilling, which pushes peak outward with a fast decline. Unconventionals won't power our current modus operandi. The myth of technology and renewables don't work. Jevons paradox, for example, or study some physics. When conventional starts to decline, all bets are due." Okay, what strikes me about this feedback that I got from Physics Nerd 1 is that I could have written this back in 2008 right down to the quip about the creamy nougat center of oil. In fact, back in the early days of this podcast, I think it was a conversation that I recorded with Nate Higgins, the one that appears in Sea Realm podcast episode number 67, which came out December 5th, 2007, in which the cover art features a cross-section of the planet with the molten core labeled Creamy Nougat Center. And when Physics Nerd 1 says, When conventional starts to decline, all bets are due. Conventional peaked and has been declining since 2005. So what I'm reading here is basically the thoughts of a person who stopped thinking about this topic about a decade ago. The worldview expressed in this comment is out of date. The person who typed it out did so reflexively, not thoughtfully. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't thoughtful people still grappling with the topic of peak oil. I think Richard Heinberg is definitely still slugging it out, but I have to say I'm just less and less impressed with what I'm hearing from people in the peak oil field. And earlier, very early in this year, in fact, says the year is still quite new, in the first episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast of the new year, episode number 323, I talked to blogger and I would say peak oil aficionado or enthusiast, Bob Brown. And in the conversation with Bob, I basically said, you know, I regret having given the topic of peak oil so much of my time and attention and credulity over the last decade plus. I think that the effects that mobile computing and social media have had in that time, and that's when I mean later on when I'll say that the iPhone has had a bigger impact on the way we live our lives over the past decade and change than peak oil has had. When I say the iPhone, I mean the iPhone and its imitators and the social media that became so popular once everybody was carrying around what would in decades past have been considered a supercomputer. So I guess my current position is that the peak oil narrative either needs to incorporate some new variables, broaden its scope, and take in more information from the world around us, or basically just throw in the towel and admit that as a near future predictor, it's not a very useful or helpful model. I'll say a bit more about this at the end of the episode, but for now, here is my most recent recorded conversation with James Howard Kunstler.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Okay, so I'm at the home of James Howard Kunstler. Got here yesterday. We had a very pleasant chat last night, nice dinner, and we just recorded a segment for the Sea Realm Vault podcast in which we talk about things that I think we pretty much are in agreement on. So now,
including some very dangerous territory.
Oh, yes. But now we're going to tussle.
Tussle?
Tussle.
Okay, I'll do my best.
So, over a year ago, I went down to Pennsylvania. Kevin Lynn bought me a ticket, and we went to see Sam Harris live.
And, oh, no kidding.
Yeah, as we were driving from Lancaster to Philadelphia, which is where we saw Sam Harris, we were listening to a podcast. And it was a podcast from, you know, a familiar voice in the peak oil sphere. And it was an interview, and I forget who was being interviewed, but it's not really important for the purposes of this discussion. But the thing is, the conversation they were having was identical to conversations I was having around the topic of peak oil in 2008. And I thought, wow, you know, because I've moved on from the peak oil topic. I think I've said everything there is to say about that, or heard other people say everything there is to say about that. To the point where, you know, the points were becoming very familiar. And I thought, damn, the peak oil conversation hasn't progressed any further than this in the 10 years since I encountered it. I was really unimpressed. So unimpressed that I had to voice my my dissatisfaction. We changed to another, you know, another audio track to listen to as we drove. And recently I had somebody on the Sea Realm Vault podcast. He's a blogger. And I'll have him on the main Sea Realm podcast pretty soon here. And his name is Bob Brown, and he's very much a peak oil guy. I think he's an engineer. Certainly, you know, he knows his stuff. But we having a conversation, and at the end of the conversation, I said something to the effect of, you know, I started this podcast back in 2006. 2006 is also the year that the iPhone debuted. And say in 2007, 2008, when I was really getting into the peak oil topic, if somebody had said to me that the iPhone is going to have a much bigger impact on society over the coming decade than, you know, fossil fuel shortfalls will, I would have been really, you know, I would have pushed back hard against that. But now that we have lived through that decade and we've had, you know, our Twitter president and we've had the social media polarization of the society and, you know, basically people have been driven into these insane ideological silos,
you know, and they have camped and they have set up opposing camps.
And planted their flags.
Oh, definitely planted flags. I think that really, if I had focused on the effects of ubiquitous mobile computing and social media starting in, say, 2006, when really those were incipient topics, that the CROM podcast would have been a much better guide to how to navigate the contemporary scene than having spent, you know, a solid 5 years really focusing on peak oil issues. And he disagreed, but that conversation led me to dip my toe back into the contemporary peak oil scene. And I find in peak oil the same dynamic in that the people who are the articulators of the message have one mentality, but the people who are attracted to the message have a very different mentality. And I found the same thing with antinatalism, you know, which is the belief that you shouldn't have children because that increases suffering. I find the same thing in various conspiracy circles, although, the articulators of the conspiracy messages are not as good as the antinatalists or the peak oil people. But I find it in peak oil as well, that there's just a lot of really damaged people who gravitate to peak oil for reasons that really deserve some self-examination, and that the message itself is not very strong. It's particularly as a predictor of near-term future events. And Richard Heinberg has recently, I haven't read it yet, but I've had other people summarize it for me, basically just, he's wrung his hands publicly saying, boy, I really got the predictions wrong, certainly got the timing very wrong. What went wrong? What was wrong with the message? What was wrong with the worldview that I've been articulating? And I think his summation, and again, I'm reporting this secondhand because I haven't read it, but his summation is, well, I underestimated the value of extend and pretend, you know, of the resilience of this strategy, which to me says I overestimated the vulnerability that this society has, at least in the short term, based on, you know, fossil fuel production.
Well, I look at it a bit differently, naturally, and first of all, there are a couple of things we can say about this. One is that the peak oil debate or issue is, and the technology, iPhone, social effects of communication technology, these two issues are not mutually exclusive. You know, to pay attention to one or see the effects of one and measure it against the other doesn't negate the other. That's one thing. Another thing is that there's a kind of an 80-20 Pareto distribution of anything, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of a law of the universe.
Spell that out for people who aren't familiar with it.
Pareto.
No, I mean, spell it out conceptually. What are you saying? The 80-20 rule.
Well, it means that in any given statistical group of people, or there's usually an 80% to 20% distribution of people who are, like, let's say in a company, 80% of the people in a company are devoted to nothing but the issues about the survival of the company itself, and 20% are dedicated to what their actual mission is.
Right.
You know, making a product or being an agency to regulate, you know. It's especially true in government regulation agencies because they're not putting out a product. They have a duty to attend to. But, you know, 80% of the people employed there will be dedicated to just keeping the growth of the agency going, and 20% will be carrying out its work.
The primary objective of any organization is the perpetuation of the organization.
Right, and you just explained it better than I did.
Well, so that's what the comic strip I do is ultimately about.
Okay.
It's basically a long sort of gag-oriented approach to the Peter Principle.
Yeah, and which is rising to your level of incompetence.
And then staying there and bloating your organization with essentially dead weight. Except most people stay in the position that they're in because they're not qualified to do the job above them, but also because they demonstrate institutional values.
Yeah.
They say the right things at work. They do the things which demonstrate their devotion to the perpetuation of the institution, which largely means demonstrating that you have the right values. So virtue signaling, you know, but it's been going on since long before that was a phrase.
Well, also, one of the reasons for that is that status seeking is built into the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And virtue signaling is all about status seeking.
Yeah.
You know, getting brownie points for thinking correctly and being a good person, in quotes. Anyway, back to peak oil. My own view of it is that the last 10 years has been a kind of an interesting fake out that you can understand pretty easily. It's the public basically misunderstood what happened, and especially what happened with shale oil. And especially what happened with shale oil in relation to finance. And one of the underlying themes of Chris Martinson's work at Peak Prosperity is the very intimate relationship between financial operations, shall we say, of various kinds, including markets, interest rates, regulation by central banks, all of that, and energy. And so what we saw in the period from 2008 to 2019 was kind of a magnificent financial stunt. We were able to ramp up this activity called shale oil and ramp up oil production from its previous 1970 peak of 10 million barrels a day, which had gone down to something like 4 million and change. Around 2008, and we ramped it back way back up above the 1970 peak to 12 million barrels a day now in January of 2019. The whole thing was a financial stunt enabled by 10 years of zero interest rate policy or near zero or ultra low interest rate policy and the tremendous accumulation of debt. Now, in general, you know, the debt accumulation for, I think it's the world, there are various ways of toting that up, but it may be something like $60 trillion. But in the shale oil industry, it was about $300 billion in loaned money to get that oil out of the ground. Now, the problem was is that very few of the companies involved were making any money producing shale oil. So it was basically a subsidy from the, you know, courtesy of the central bank with ultra-low interest rates for them to get cheap loans to do this. Now, the problem now is that the debt structure of the world and of the USA within that world is beginning to crumble because we've lost our ability to generate new debt. The reason for that is because it is now apparent that we can't pay back the old debt. And when you can't pay back the old debt, you're less likely to get new borrowings. And the reason we can't get new borrowings is that the collateral for that debt was the belief that we would continue to have unlimited economic growth of the kind that we depended on, which is to say industrial growth, technical industrial growth, that characterized the last 200 years. Part and parcel of which was the financial system that we constructed within that techno-industrial civilization. And it depended on the regular production of a certain amount of new wealth every year to justify the debt-based currencies that the world runs on. And the problem is that when you reach an energy limit, that you encounter a hard limit to exactly that kind of growth. You cannot produce that kind of industrial growth of wealth anymore. And the hallmark of that is that shale oil doesn't make any money. You can't make a buck producing shale oil, which means that it is not sustainable. It means that it was a byproduct of the central bank policies of the last 10 years, and it faked everybody out. It was a stunt to that had, you know, I don't actually don't think it had a programmatic purpose to deceive people. I think it was really the action of a desperate society to keep its to run the stuff that to keep the stuff it's running going.
That is exactly why I'm thoroughly unconvinced that finance is going to stop oil production anytime in the foreseeable future, because we are desperate for a continued supply of fossil fuels. And I'm just channeling our mutual friend John Michael Greer here. For the peak oil fast collapse to proceed in the way that the most alarmist of its presenters say, it requires that people in charge of government, finance, you know, the powers that be, do absolutely nothing. And they're not going to do absolutely nothing. They are going to continue to reach into their pants and pull out financial shenanigans to keep this thing going up to and including, I think, simply just nationalizing oil production.
I was about to say that that's
operating it at a loss.
That's really the last card they can play.
But it could be a card that you know keeps the game going for a good long time.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it remains to be seen because, you know, the companion problem to that is that the government itself is bankrupt. So, you know, to some extent, if it did nationalize the shale industry and did keep it going by shoveling money into it, mm-hmm. it could easily be within the context of a government economy that was itself collapsing and unable to really generate the money, or couldn't even pretend anymore, because there are certain things that can start to run out of control, like interest rates. So I
would say, look at Venezuela. I mean, the Venezuelan economy is totally in the toilet. Their monetary system is completely out of control. They've got hyperinflation that, you know, they're pushing money around in wheelbarrows, and it just doesn't even warrant consideration that, you know, Venezuela will be ruins in a decade. There will still be a Caracas there. There will still be buses driving around. You know, their monetary system will have to be reformulated. They will, you know, probably they'll get a more right-wing government in there at some point. And, you know, they're just going to have to renegotiate their financial standing with the rest of the world. But it's not going to be a ghost town, you know.
It won't be a ghost town, but you know, it could actually be continue to be a failed state. Even the government, I think, can't continue to extend the pretend, because there will be certain consequences to the actions that they take by continuing to generate more debt that can't be paid back, and the probable outcome of that is that they will destroy the value of the dollar. And now that crisis hasn't occurred yet, but when it does, you know, that will be a serious game changer in all of this. And I'm just not persuaded that the so-called new monetary policy, which states as one of its core principles that debt doesn't matter and you can keep on generating it perpetually, I just don't buy that argument. You know, I think that there are unintended consequences, and, you know, you just can't squash these things down. If they don't express themselves in one way, you know, they'll express themselves in another way.
Well, debt doesn't matter, and debt will be, you know, will lead to the end of industrialism are two extremes, you know, two extreme positions. And in between, I think, is where reality is going to play out.
Well,
the debt does matter, but as David Graeber articulates in Debt, the First 5,000 Years, we only talk about, you know, the hard, inescapable, you know, morality of debt when it's poor people who owe money to rich people. When the powerful, you know, have debts to one another, those debts are always fluid and negotiable. And particularly when the collapse of industrial civilization is on the line, those debts become particularly fluid and negotiable.
Well, yes, but what are the terms of the negotiations? The terms of the negotiations, they really have only two possible outcomes. One is negotiating, one is forcing the creditor to take a haircut. Mm-hmm. And the other one is pretending that the debt went away. But unfortunately, pretending that debt went away ends up, you know, producing problems with markets and currencies and interest rates, because, you know, you can't really pretend. The debts don't go away. So pretending that the debt will go away really is just a self-deception, because it eventually bites back. The reality is the debt doesn't go away. It will find some way to express itself. It could be, you know, a really tough inflation or a hyperinflation, or it could be, you know, some other currency kind of problem, or it could be, you know, it could express itself in the failure of trade relations or market irregularities and crashes. You know, there are all kinds of ways it can express itself. But, you know, forcing creditors to take a haircut has a very clear result, which is that wealth definitely disappears. You know, I mean, if you tell some creditor that, you know, you're only going to get back 40% of your principal on the bond, you know, that's painful. And it basically makes the whole society less wealthy.
So, yeah, you know, 40% is infinitely better than 0%.
Well, I don't know, infinitely better. It's 60% better or something.
No,
like
it's infinitely better.
Well, all right. I'm not a math guy, but
divide by zero.
But anyway, you know, the practical matter is really sort of what goes first. You know, what part of the financial system is the weak link that breaks, and I think we've reached a threshold where we can't continue generating new debt because the collateral, the belief in future growth, is no longer credible. And the thing about the financial system is that of all the systems that we depend on, that are all subsystems of the larger techno-industrial system we live within, finance is the most fragile because it's the most abstract. And it's the most abstract because so much of what it does depends on people's trust and faith in the activities that, and the instruments that they use.
But because it is so abstract and so faith-based, it is the most fluid and the most easy to restructure.
That's an interesting point, but I think the weakness of that is that once faith is lost or wobbles or is compromised, it really goes very fast.
It does, but it doesn't stay gone. I mean, the economy of the United States has collapsed before. It collapsed in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you rebuild.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
All right, we are back. You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm KMO, and I'm talking with James Howard Kunstler about debt, oil, finance, faith, and related topics. So, Jim, you were just articulating why you think debt matters and why the significance of debt is that it lends credence to the notion of a rapid collapse of industrial civilization under the general explanatory umbrella of peak oil.
Yeah,
I used to be wholehearted not only enthusiast for this idea but an articulator of it, and over the past decade and a half, I have seen the predictions of the peak oil doomsayers fail to materialize, and I have seen much more interesting social and political emergent phenomena that come from technology. And I wish I had been more tuned in to the technical goings on and less tuned in to the notions of peak oil, because I made some stupid life decisions based on the idea that industrial civilization was coming up to a very rapid crash, and the timing was just terrible for me, because I really got into the notion of peak oil in early 2007, and then in mid-2008, the oil price spiked, and then in the fall of 2008, basically we had the fallout from the housing bubble. And so it really seemed to provide me with very tangible evidence that this whole peak oil worldview was spot on, and that it was coming to a head right now. And it wasn't. You know, I remember the summer of 2008, I was talking to my uncle, who was a cattle farmer in Arkansas. And, you know, we were talking about the price of gas, because the price of gas really affects his livelihood.
Sure.
And, you know, I started to give him the peak oil explanation, because, you know, multiple peak oil aficionados at the time were saying, this is not a price spike, this is the new floor, this is the new price of oil. And my uncle, you know, who's a cattle farmer, said, no, it's a speculative bubble, it's going to go back down. And who was right?
He was right. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely
wrong. Well, it was
wrong.
Kind of both, though.
But it wasn't. The price was in $35 a barrel by December of that year.
Yeah, but, you know...
It was certainly a speculative bubble. That's the explanation for the 2008 price of oil.
Well, if there's certainly an awful lot of action in the oil price takes place in markets that, that you know, have strange emergent properties that are not easy to predict because they're nonlinear. Mm-hmm. I think Gail Tverberg, who runs the website Our Finite Earth, probably has the most interesting view of why the oil price won't necessarily stay high in some kind of a fossil fuel emergency. You know, she's retired now, but she was an actuary.
She is Gail the Actuary.
Right, and she started out as a commentator on the Oil Drum website. And when that folded, she started her own website, and she's really, really smart and understands numbers, you know, and has worked with numbers and the calculus of different forces on other forces. And she really gets it. Art Berman, who is a Houston-based oil analyst, I think, who does not have exactly the same view as Gail, but also has, I think, a very clear-eyed view of where we're at in the oil game. And I would say he has a pretty pessimistic view of it. You know, my own is that, you know, if you look at the charts of the last 10 years from 2008 and the crash going forward to now in 2019, you know, one thing you see is that there is a direct connection between the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing, bond buying, zero interest rate policy, and oil production. That, you know, as quantitative easing went on and the creation of more and more money from nowhere, out of nothing, out of thin air, occurred, the shale oil industry was able to ramp up. And it did that largely on the basis of very low interest, covenant-lite loans that were, in a sense, you know, junk financing or what have been called junk bonds because... They have a tendency to blow up. They're high-risk bonds. That's why they're called junk bonds. So much of the lending in shale oil has been junk financing that was only made possible by the activities of the central bank and the creation of ultra-low interest rate policy. If you actually look at the charts for just the last few months, in November of 2018... There was literally no junk financing that came out of the shale oil sector for that month. That also was a month where there was tremendous instability in the financial markets, where the interest rates on American sovereign U.S. Treasury bonds started to rise to a very dangerous territory, which is, you know, over 3.2% in the 10-year benchmark bond. And so as the price of bonds started to creep up to levels that were apprehended to be dangerous, mm-hmm. all of a sudden the lending to the shale industry stopped. And they can't run the shale industry.
What year was that?
That was just a few months ago, in November of 2018. And that was just 1 month that they didn't get the financing. But, you know, these guys have to roll over their financing constantly because the wells deplete so quickly. They have to re-drill and refrack and do these very expensive operations incessantly. And, you know, I'm not going to revisit some of those central ideas like the Red Queen syndrome, et cetera. But it's very, very difficult. It's probably impossible for them to continue at the rate that they've been producing without that stream at that volume of cheap financing. And that's going to go away. And it's going to go away because, as I said, there's the expectation that we're not going to grow our way out of this. And as that becomes more firmly understood by the public, then the shale oil industry is going to crash, or it's going to disappear, evaporate. My own view is that it will happen very quickly because the industry was ramped up so quickly. You know, basically in 15 years, it just went from, you know, from nothing to producing, you know, I don't know, 12, 15 million. They went from 4.5 million barrels a day to 12 million barrels, whatever that rises, eight and change or something, or seven and change. I do want to touch on what you said about Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that they're, you know, I kind of think that it's behaving now like a failed state, in the classic sense of a failed state, and I'm not sure it's going to pull its butt out of there. And
I think the Maduro government still has a monopoly on violence.
Yeah, for the moment they do, although even today the scene is changing.
I mean, that's pretty much the definition of a failed state, is that your central government no longer has a credible monopoly on the use of force.
Right, but I mean, just in the last 24 hours, the U.S. anyway has recognized an alt-president of Venezuela.
I think that Brazil and the U.S. are going to engineer Maduro's ouster one way or another.
Yeah, I think that that's a good call.
Covertly, yeah.
That's a good call. My point is this, is that the Chavez regime, which preceded Maduro, did so much damage to the Venezuelan oil system itself, the industry itself, that I'm not sure the industry itself can recover. It may be too damaged.
As long as there is technically recoverable oil under the ground there, somebody will be able to finance it.
Well, that may be, and it may be the intention of the U.S. Or maybe even China to somehow go in there, take control of a new Venezuelan regime, and really put their people in charge of the oil industry. You know, if in the U.S. it would be like tell ExxonMobil to go in and, you know, take over the Venezuelan oil industry, or invite any number of other international oil companies going to make this thing run right.
Or to lay out a map of Iraq and put various oil companies down on the map.
I got to qualify that by saying I believe that we're moving into a global period of much greater instability and disorder than we have been in the period 2008 to 2018. And I think that's going to have an effect on whether any of these things happen. Including whether even states like China and the USA have the capacity to work their hoodoo on failed states like Venezuela. I'm not convinced. I wouldn't automatically assume that that's going to be possible. Because we're all entering so much disorder and trouble that we may be preoccupied with our own trouble. China, I think, is probably in deeper financial trouble than the public really is paying attention to. Their banking system is really very janky. And, you know, unfortunately for them, they don't even have the weak regulatory apparatus that we have in the West, because the banking system is under the Communist Party of China. And they don't have to, the banking system does not have to account to anybody but the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party.
Are you familiar with the One Belt, One Road?
Of course.
Yeah. So it seems like China is very focused on very tangible material concerns, you know, in terms of getting what they need to keep their country going. And they need to maintain a certain level of growth just to offset, you know, growing discontent among the large portion of their population, which is not seeing any cut of this newfound wealth.
That's why they spent the last, you know, 20 years building 60 million units of apartment houses that are empty and unsold.
Well, I think that was more somebody was making a profit for everything that got built, regardless of whether or not there was a buyer.
Yeah, but it was also to the advantage of the party leadership. Just to have some kind of economic activity, whatever it was.
Those ghost cities now are falling apart. They were so shoddily constructed. I mean, they were not really serious.
I got photographs from a friend of mine who was teaching English in China, and he was going around shooting the construction quality of the new cities. And, I mean, you could see stuff like...
Was he doing it on a motorcycle?
I don't remember.
Oh, there's a YouTube channel with two guys, I think a British guy and an American guy, and they ride around on their motorcycles in China, because they live there. And, you know, they show you various aspects of what China is like these days. And, yeah, they did do a tour through the ghost cities and just got up right close to some of these buildings, which are just crumbling.
Well, you see things, too, like, you know, the masonry veneers on the ground floor don't even meet the sidewalk. there's like a 2-inch gap between the masonry of the building and the sidewalk. And I mean, that's just a clue to how badly they're constructed. The quality of the cement is atrocious. You know, they use as little cement in the mix as possible, and it's mostly sand. And that's not a good call, especially when you're building 40-story towers.
So you're not using steel in the rebar and not some cheap substitute or some low-quality steel.
The general point I was making is I wouldn't underestimate the disorder that the global situation is going to be in the next couple of years. You know, I think we're really entering a new phase of the disorders that began in the early 2000s. And I do maintain that your view of the peak oil situation and your disappointment
I'm not disappointed that the world hasn't gone up in flames.
Well, your disappointment with how the story seemed to work out.
Dissatisfaction.
Yeah. I think that was a fake out. I think you'll turn, you know, it was a long, sustained 10-year fake out, but I think it'll turn out to be a fake out, and, you know, we're going to be pretty much back in the same situation, and pretty soon, because as I said, I think the shale oil industry is going to fail as rapidly, if not more rapidly, than it arose. And it was one of the most phenomenally fast-acting things that has happened in the whole industrial history to get to that point where you could produce that much oil that quickly was really quite an amazing stunt, but it was a stunt. You know, finally, the only other thing about it is that and something people misunderstand too is that the quality and the character of the oil that they get out of the shale happens to be very different from what we have gotten out of conventional oil wells. And the main difference is that it's a much lighter product.
Meaning what?
Meaning you don't get diesel fuel and aviation fuel out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the stuff that you get is, you know, gasoline and above.
Well, just you know, oil 101. Would you run through the distinctions between
oil
light
and
heavy, sour and sweet?
Yeah, petroleum that comes out of the ground, crude oil, is a mixture of different chemical substances that all have a different molecular weight or construction. Mm-hmm. And when you distill them in a refinery, which is basically boiling them, the distillates boil off at different temperatures, and that's how you capture them and separate them. You have this big mass of crude oil, you put it in a distillery, and you run it at different sequences and temperatures, and you get bunker oil, which is used as for ships. You get heating oil, which is very heavy grade for home heating. You get kerosene, which has its obvious uses. You get aviation fuel, which is sort of a form of kerosene, unleaded kerosene. You get various grades of gasoline. And then you get the things that you go further up the molecular scale, they start to turn into gases eventually, or compressible gases like butane, you know, which is a liquid under certain circumstances and, you know, and a gas when it's not under pressure.
Basically, it's about the sulfur content and the viscosity. If you go back to our earlier conversations, I was explaining Nigeria's tale of woes. They're a country that was sending sort of 1.3 million barrels a day to the States, now pretty much sends next to nothing. And if you look at the shale revolution, why are the Nigerians and the Angolans suffering? They're suffering because their particular variety of crude oil is very close to US light, i.e. the sulfur content in terms of what the refiners need stateside. The composition, the sulfur content, the viscosity of Nigerian and Angolan crude is very similar to what tight oil and shale oil players are producing in the States. So the Nigerian demand has just been constantly declining to a point of zero. Now, the Saudis still send crude oil to the US. At one point in time, they around 2002, 2003, they used to export about 30% of Saudi exports used to go to the US. Now it's down to about 18%, and it's been around 18% for a couple of fiscal years, 18 to 20, 21, then coming back down to 18. And the reason for that is that the Saudi crude is, to use your ladder expression, of a slightly heavier variety. So there are different kinds of refiners who need different different varieties of crude, and the Saudis still find a market with the heavier ones, whereas the Nigerians and Angolans, whose crude oil was very similar to bulk of the US produce, are in trouble. So it all boils down to the sulfur content and the viscosity, and it might or it might not surprise you to learn that there are over 100 plus varieties of crude oils, each with their different levels of sulfur content in terms of viscosity. I think the most fascinating crude oil that I have seen in sort of 11 years of analysis was something that I spotted in Oman, where the crude oil was so pure that it really needed next to negligible refining for you to use it as a fuel medium. And that's fascinating. The Omanis they used to be heavyweights in the 60s and the 70s, but they're no longer heavyweights in the oil and gas business. But their crude is, to use the expression, the sweetest variety.
Well, we're coming up on the end here.
Yeah.
And I know this is a longstanding point of disagreement between you and John Michael Greer. He has the... it's his staked out position and his flag is in it, that collapse takes a century or so, and people will live their whole lives through the collapse and think it's normal. And you've staked out a position that's much closer to the fast collapse narrative, where things go south quickly. And right now, I mean, given my experience over the last decade and the arguments that I've heard, I'm more convinced by JMG's view.
I'm actually not that far from JMG's view.
Well, I asked him about that, and he said the differences between you are pretty substantial.
Well, okay, then I would disagree. I do think that his stair-step metaphor for catabolic collapse, as he calls it, is a good model. I actually do. And it really is pretty much the model of my world made by hand novels.
But his stair-step collapse is a collapse and then a partial recovery, which, while the partial recovery is in progress, it will seem as though we're back on the, you know, upwards.
Well, I think you're
trajectory.
Misinterpreting that, because I've talked
many times about this.
Okay, but I'll explain my interpretation of it, okay. Is that, and I'll explain the difference, which is that, you know, you go down a step, and I think initially the first step is probably a big step. It's a step that hurts when you land on the landing below. Mm-hmm. And it's a shock to the system. And then there are steps that continue beyond that, and there are more regular steps down, I think. But I don't think it's a recovery when you hit the step. What it's more a matter of a cognitive or mental normalizing.
It's the new normal.
In fact, you're not really recovering. All you're doing is sort of recovering your psychological balance in the face of circumstances that have changed markedly.
That makes sense, but that's not JMG's view. I mean, a partial recovery after each catabolic stair-step collapse is definitely baked into his worldview.
I will definitely accept the idea that a certain amount of stability or the appearance of stability will probably happen for a limited period of time, but I think that most of it will be illusory, and that, you know, the steps down will be fairly regular after that, and you know, each one will have its strange effect of normalizing the drop in your standard of living. That was portrayed interestingly in the novel The Mandibles by Lionel Shriver.
Good novel.
Which came out. I didn't like it that much, actually. I admired it without liking it that much, and I think she kind of blew the end of it.
She writes great dialogue, and she has very memorable characters. I think she's really good in that writing.
Yeah, it had its virtues. I think she rushed through the ending and didn't really think through it very well. But
she's also a really on-the-nose libertarian gold bug, and that comes through very clearly in the novel.
Yeah. So the novel really takes place over a period of about 20 years in the lives of a family called the Mandibles, who were, upper middle class in the early 2000s. And along with everybody else in America, their standard of living has crashed, and they're and they're living in a kind of state of desperation. But the novel takes place over, like 20, 30 years.
Most of it's not depicted, though. I mean, we have the novel unfold in a fairly short period of a few months, and then there is a decades-long gap, and then we pick up with the characters later.
Right.
The surviving characters.
Yeah. So, the book had its appeal, and it was a way of illustrating the catabolic collapse idea. So if you're interested, go to that. I'm naturally, because I was the author of it, I'm more in favor of my world made by hand view of how things work out.
Let me ask you, when you started that series, so the first book, World Made by Hand, mm-hmm. when did you envision the collapse happening for that book? I mean, the remnants of industrial society are from what year?
I think that I was thinking about 10 years ahead.
About now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that that was, it was going to be sooner rather than further ahead. So that was my notion. And, of course, a lot of, really all of the action in that book has taken place after that initial first drop. And, people are pretty shocked by it. And, in fact, the denizens of my little fictional town, one of their main characteristics is how shocked and depressed they are in general about what has happened to them. And I attempted to contrast them with this group of evangelicals who's landed in town, who have fled Dixieland. And they're living in a kind of re-enchanted, neo-medieval kind of mental world. But, for them,
they seem much happier.
Yeah, for the bottom line for them is that they're happier and they're more purposeful. The problem with being depressed all the time is that it tends to prevent you from carrying out the things that you have to do to improve your situation. And so, this group that has landed in their midst, these foreigners, really, are kind of instructing them, how to rescue themselves. Anyway.
We've talked about this before. You said when you first introduced the character of Brother Job, you thought he might be the villain of the piece.
Yeah, I wasn't sure I was going with that.
That really is clear in that first encounter. He seems really manipulative and sort of predatory.
And sinister.
Yeah.
Yeah. But and a lot of that came from the fact that way, way back when I was a newspaper reporter, I kind of dedicated about a year or two to investigating religious cults. Because they were really there was a lot of that action in the early 70s, and I was fascinated by it, about how young adult people would sell their allegiance and their personal sovereignty to some jackass who was running a cult. So I went into the book with some of the residue of that thinking, but I eventually began to as happens in any fiction that works really well. The characters start to behave according to their own logic. And that happened with these people, and they ended up being rather heroic. Anyway, I don't want to blow my own horn, but, Lionel Shriver's got an interesting portrayal of a crash. I think mine is. JMG has several fantasy science fiction treatments of crash and collapse. And
mm-hmm. What is his world called? He's like opened it up. It's an open universe. Anybody can write in it now. Well,
I forget.
Yeah,
because as I've told you before, I don't read a whole lot of other people's collapse fiction.
Jim, I think we first met in 2007. I mean, we had spoken on Skype before, but face to face, we first met in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
At the Congress for the New Urbanism gathering.
Yeah.
And so that was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Provided we're both hale and healthy 12 years from now, let's sit down and revisit this conversation. We'll talk before then.
Oh, sure.
But, decidedly, let's check back, in a decade.
I think this year itself is going to be very interesting because, personally, I believe that a lot of the debt issues are going to assert themselves this year in a hard way. And, you know, we'll begin to see the loss of faith and trust in things like bonds and see how that works out in relation to the energy situation.
Well, here's something I've encountered among peak oil folk. I mean, if there is not a collapse, if the economy manages to stumble on for another couple of decades, things are moving so fast in artificial intelligence that we are going to have to face and deal with a lot of emergent behavior from our technology that I think a lot of people who are interested in peak oil say, oh, we don't have to think about that because the economy is going to crash and it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a good chance that it will happen, that mm-hmm. we will have to deal with these issues and that we should be thinking about them now.
For sure. I agree with you. I'm pretty troubled with some AI issues, really most, if not all, AI issues. And yeah, I wouldn't dismiss them at all. I think that in a way it is kind of a race between whether this civilization has to reset at a lower level and we stop dabbling in these sorcerer's apprentice technologies.
I don't think we will stop.
And
the Faustian technology is just too appealing, and I think 99 people out of 100 can be living in abject poverty, and that process will continue.
That's a plausible outcome to me. I think that's an intelligent way of thinking about it.
Well, Jim, this is clearly an ongoing conversation. We won't finish it on this recording, but thank you very much for having me as a guest in your home, and thanks for your ongoing participation on the Sea Realm podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on, and we will ride again.
Absolutely.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back to its back, old dimensions.
That was James Howard Kunstler, and as you well know, he is the author of many books, both fictional and nonfiction, on the topic of peak oil and the vulnerabilities of a technology-reliant society. Now, my current position on peak oil and what you should do about it is this. Don't do anything to prepare for a peak oil fast collapse that you wouldn't find fulfilling in the absence of such a collapse. So I think Jim Kunstler is a great example. He's a really good cook. He plays several musical instruments with other people. He has a big-ass garden. He keeps chickens. He paints. He writes books, both fiction and nonfiction. He writes plays. He writes a blog. These are all rewarding activities, and they are enriching activities. They make him a more interesting person. They make him, I would say, a better person than somebody who does none of these things. His response to the belief system that he holds about where industrial society is going, particularly with regard to peak oil, makes a great deal of sense to me, and I think is an admirable adaptation to that worldview. You know, many of the people that I've spoken to recently who wish to defend the peak oil worldview from my criticisms will invoke the name of Gail Teverberg, otherwise known as Gail the Actuary, somebody whom I have interviewed repeatedly over the years, although not recently. But Gail Teverberg's website is Our Finite World. And if you go to that website right now, the most recent blog post there is entitled, How the Peak Oil Story Could Be So Close in scare quotes, but not quite right. On resilience.org, a website that will be familiar to anybody who has followed the peak oil scene for any length of time, Richard Heinberg published an essay back in mid-December of 2018. It's called The Big Picture, and in it he invokes the adaptive cycle of the panarchists, the one with the growth-slash-exploitation phase leading up to a phase of conservation through a collapse and release phase and then to a reorganizational phase and then back to the growth and exploitation phase. Which, I should point out, this adaptive cycle applies to complex adaptive systems. So if you are invoking this model to discuss your predictions about where industrial civilization is going, well, the model itself implies that civilization will not collapse in the simplistic fast-collapse peak oil manner, whereby complexity drops and then stays low forever. Rigid, brittle systems break like that. Complex adaptive systems do not. But later in this essay, Richard Heinberg is musing over How is it that the peak oil story, being so compelling, could be so roundly ignored by most people? And to flesh out his explanation, he appeals to neuroscience, and he talks about the differences between dopamine reward systems and serotonin reward systems in the brain. And I think if you're going to invoke neurological reward systems and neurochemistry, this can be applied much more fruitfully to, you know, the topic that I find more compelling now, about how social media and how ubiquitous computing in the form of smartphones, tablets, and that sort of thing have affected our experience of the world, how we regard one another, how we relate to one another, the, I would say, rampant tribalism, which is not only wreaking havoc in politics, but in society in general. All of this, I think, is much more interesting when you apply it to mobile computing, social media, and artificial intelligence than it is when applied to petroleum geology and the economics specifically related to that field. I'm not saying it doesn't apply. I'm just saying that invoking this model and then not talking about information technology, ubiquitous computing, long-distance communication, really seems to require a very specific, esoteric, and motivated focus. When I was at Jim's house, he had a book sitting out. It's called Lean Logic by David Fleming. And I opened it at random, and I looked at some of the passages that Jim had underlined, and one of them was a piece of advice from the author saying, the best thing you can do to prepare for collapse or to prepare for the lean times to come is to join a choir. And I think the reasoning behind it is largely the same reasoning which lends me to judge Jim's efforts so positively. You know, his efforts of learning to play instruments, joining bands, painting, basically doing all of the things that put you in touch with the people around you who are doing similar things and fully engaging with the opportunities that life presents in the here and now, with no certainty about how the future will unfold. The things that you can do to prepare for peak oil and for a fast collapse, which don't make sense if the collapse doesn't appear on schedule, are things that you will regret. Say, spending a considerable portion of your savings on survival gear, freeze-dried foods, selling a house in a neighborhood that really worked for you in order to buy some land on which to build your doomstead. These are things that you will regret. Unless, of course, they bring you into happy and convivial contact with other people doing similar things. I agree with Jim that one doesn't have to pick, you know, oil economics or technology and focus just on one or the other, because the two overlap. They certainly overlap. But it isn't peak oil that has my kids glued to their screens all day and pushing into their early adulthood years with absolutely no useful, workable experience of, you know, getting along as a social being in a world of face-to-face contacts and work. But I will make a prediction here, even though I admit, in fact, I assert, predicting the future is incredibly difficult, and even very intelligent people who are making a good faith effort at making predictions about the future will get it wrong. But here's something that I'm pretty sure will happen. Somebody, in defending the peak oil worldview, will respond to me and this podcast, and they will criticize me and accuse me of being a techno-utopian, of saying that a post-scarcity society is right around the corner, that there is an infinite supply of oil to be had, that growth on a finite planet can continue indefinitely. I'm not saying any of these things. I'm saying that information technology, ubiquitous, powerful mobile computing, the touchscreen interface, and social media have had a much greater impact on the way we relate to one another as human beings and citizens in our society, has had a much greater impact on our politics, has had a much greater impact on our way of life than petroleum production shortfalls over the last decade. If you want to refute that claim, I would be very interested to hear or read said refutation. But I'm sure just about everybody who responds to this with indignation is going to move the goalpost, is going to mischaracterize what I've said, even in spite of the fact that I've predicted right here that they're going to do it, thus giving them a heads up that I'm waiting for just that sort of move. It will happen anyway. That's my prediction. and I'm pretty confident in it. But I can't say that I fully regret having invested all of that time and energy and credulity in the peak oil story, because it certainly has brought me into contact with a number of very interesting characters. And I think possibly most importantly, it situated me at the EcoVillage Training Center for 2 years. You know, the EcoVillage Training Center on the farm in Summertown, Tennessee. A lot of people come through there. I got to meet a lot of really great people in my time there at the EcoVillage Training Center, and I got to live a pretty spare existence, basically living in a cabin in the woods with no running water, but I did have electricity and I did have internet. Not fast internet, but internet. And that was a really valuable experience, and I certainly wouldn't have had it if I had never really entertained the notion that the collapse of industrial civilization was at least a distinct possibility. A near-term possibility. So, to close, I'm actually, I'm fairly behind the pack in terms of people who were once quite interested in peak oil and had a following who were interested in peak oil in saying that, you know what, this topic is not nearly as interesting to me as it used to be, and I think I have explored it in as much detail as is really useful. That I've long since passed the point of diminishing returns on this topic. And you'll notice I haven't been talking about it much in recent years, but since my conversation with Bob Brown in very early January of 2019, I've been thinking about this topic a lot. And I've come to the conclusion that there are a lot of people who take refuge in the peak oil worldview because they're just not interested in grappling with the implications of information technology, machine learning, and what some people call artificial intelligence. I think AI is going to be a much bigger deal over the coming decade than peak oil will be. I think it will create problems for us. I think it is already creating great problems for us, basically accentuating the disparity between rich and poor in the supposedly rich countries of the world. That is a category of serious challenge to our economic, political, and social systems. And yet, because I say that peak oil is not going to cause civilization to crash tomorrow, and that we are going to face this host of problems, people who don't want to think about those problems are going to call me a techno-utopian. Let that sink in for a second. Do you define a techno-utopian as somebody who says that the rapid collapse of industrial civilization due to peak oil is not going to spare us from having to grapple with these much more complicated and nuanced challenges to our assumptions, to our way of life, to our way of inhabiting this planet? Is that what a techno-utopian is? That's not my understanding of the term. One more admonition. If you hear this and you get angry and you start to type out some reply to me, ask yourself, why? Why is it important that KMO understand that you are angry at having the peak oil worldview denigrated? Why is that important to you? Is your knowledge and embrace of peak oil part of your identity? Am I attacking you as an individual by criticizing this mentality? If you think about it, dispassionately, objectively, the answer is clearly no. I'm not attacking you. I'm saying that I regret giving this worldview so much of my time and attention over the past decade plus. But if you are bent out of shape about it, here's what I suggest you do. Post a link to this episode of the podcast anywhere you like and encourage people to listen to it so that they can mock me and denigrate me and congratulate each other for seeing through the cloud of illusion and lies which apparently have occluded my vision, but which have so far left your vision untouched. This is basically in the spirit of Oscar Wilde, who said that the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. Thank you very much for listening to the Sea Realm Vault subscribers and to everybody else who supports this podcast and my work in one way or another. Thank you very much for your ongoing interest and your ongoing support, and I will talk to you again quite soon. Until that time, I hope that you will stay well.